final speaker for the session is Nicole Hidro-Celardo, and she is a PhD candidate in urban studies and planning at Portland State University. Her research investigates the interaction of community health and urban governance, and is particularly interested in collaborative processes that provide additional participation opportunities for vulnerable populations. Ms. Hidro-Celardo's dissertation, of which this presentation is a part, critically examines the ability of health impact assessments to provide community voice and influence. Ms. Hidro-Celardo recently joined Oregon Health Authority's Health Impact Assessment Program.
The arrow keys really are hard to find on this. Okay. So I am excited to be here today and present a little bit of my dissertation research. And this was, well, I guess before we get into that, I have to do... I pressed the arrows. Okay. I do not have any commercial interests, but my dissertation was funded in part by a fellowship from the Oregon Transportation Research and Education Consortium, also known as OTREC. So I thank them for that. You know, HIA was given a great introduction by our first speaker, and it is a process. It's not necessarily a specific method, but it stands for health impact assessment, and it analyzes potential public health impacts of a proposed policy, program, or project for human health impacts. Embedded in that is an assumption that you're probably actually engaging a policy or a program or project that is not a traditional public health area. So we have to ask ourselves, how are we doing that, and what aspects of it are helpful and engaging and which are not. It includes 5 or 6 steps. Some people do the reporting and recommendations all in one. The first 4, these were all gone over in the first 4 are screening, scoping, assessment, and reporting. And then the last one is supposed to be monitoring and evaluation. Of course, because nobody ever has any money left over, this is the one that never gets done. So in addition to looking at a couple different aspects of health impact assessment, I am proud to say that I'm one of the first evaluations out there of HIA. So health impact assessment is targeted information, as far as I'm concerned. A lot of people talk about HIA as public health demanding a place at the table. And it is that, because we're advocating for increased public health. And I say that even with and without my state agency hat on, that we are advocating for public health, including 2 values which are embedded into HIA practice. They come from World Health Organization paperwork that is much more developed in this area than the U.S. practice. And those include democracy and equity. So the notion that people have a right to be able to control their own lives and the space around them, and that we are working towards being able to do that for all populations, including vulnerable populations, and working towards equitable health outcomes. One of the other values that is embedded within HIA is a commitment to ethical use of evidence. And this is how we can stand up and say, yeah, we're advocating for increased public health, because we see this evidence, and it is solid, and it is based on good methods that we've been using for a while within our field. So if health impact assessment is information, we have to ask ourselves, well, is this information actually influencing decisions? And once you go down that rabbit hole, you say, okay, well, how is it influencing? And who's doing the influencing? Is it the public health professionals? Or is it the communities that were supposedly offering this democratic and equity-bound process to? And I have to say, I think there's room for both. However, a lot of people who jump into the field of HIA do it because they see it as a potentially democratizing practice. So it's worth going back around and saying, okay, well, is this true? And then how can we know if the community or health interests are included and or influential? And, you know, there's this overall tendency of public participation cases to resolve conflict by leaving out participants or ignoring issues. And so when I started this out, I was really trying to make sure that we had a robust knowledge of whether or not this was occurring in HIA. So there's a couple literatures, well, not a couple, there's a lot of literatures. It's a multi-interdisciplinary practice, and there's a lot of literatures informing participation. So a couple that I'm drawing from is the participation theory, and which is separate. You know, those are theories about democracy and whatnot, and negotiation theory, which is also known as conflict resolution. So both how are we participating as individuals, and then how do we solve and deal with public conflict? I also drew, of course, in the public health field from CBPR and a similar body of literature that's increasingly known as local knowledge. I, of course, had to go look in the environmental impact assessment and health impact assessment treatment for treatment of participation. You would think that with EIA being around since NEPA was enacted way back when, that there would be this robust literature on participation and influence, and there actually is not. So that was of little to no help at all, and there's very little done on HIA as well. I also looked at some policy treatments, and one of the more promising ones kind of looked at influence from this idea that, you know, a community would have to have the opportunity to be at the table, would have to be able to express their ideas in language that was understood. And by doing that, they would be able to communicate something. And it's only after they're able to communicate something that they can actually influence things. So what hypotheses were governing this? You know, I knew that health impact assessment provides some information, but it was a little unclear what kind of information it was providing, but I was quite certain that it would be providing some sort of additional information to make public decisions. I also had a feeling, and when I was doing this, we'll see in just a moment, that the field was quite small, but it was already starting to be evident that stakeholder participation processes were dominating the field. And by that I mean processes where you grab 5 to 10 experts generally, or people who represent certain constituencies, and you pull them together into a room and you kind of go through these processes together. And those people are, you know, there's a lot of assumptions that are embedded in that. There's some assumptions that these people are representative of those they are representing, which may or may not be true, that they have all the knowledge, that they're able to go back and interact with their communities. So it's not that stakeholder participation structures are bad. They've done a lot of great things in dealing with public conflict and discourse, but there are some assumptions that make them a little bit difficult for understanding community interests. I also hypothesize that community influence only occurs to the extent that those stakeholder participation structures emphasize the community. So if the stakeholder participation structure includes community members or includes community-based organizations that have very social justice components to their mission statement or are out there, you know, talking with community members every single day, they're going to be far more likely to understand and advocate for the community's needs. I also wanted to know to what extent HIAs are participatory in nature. So, you know, just being able to say, are there citizens participating? Are there CBOs participating? Are there just professionals participating? We didn't know 4 years ago, 3 years ago, even a year ago, what that was. I wanted to know who is defining the problem and are setting the agendas. As my study shows, the scoping phase, where you're kind of making some really intense decisions about what's going to be included in this process, has a lot of influence on what the process becomes. And so we want to know who's defining that problem. And then as the evaluation or assessment or methods, as different people call them, is occurring, is the local knowledge being integrated with the professional knowledge? And through that, we can ask, are local communities able to influence decision-making? And I will show you how I was able to measure that. So I went with a case study approach. When I was trying to nail this down, it was in 2010, and there were 61 HIAs in the U.S., and that had doubled since 2007. So when I checked about 2 months ago, we were at 263. So this is obviously a really fast growing field. And so this is a qualitative case study approach. I cannot claim representativeness of everything, and quite frankly, even if I could, it's growing so fast and so quickly that I'm not sure it would be fair to do so. However, I do think that there are some really interesting things that are showing up. When I chose my cases, I had to make some decisions. At the time, there was a lot of clustering on the West Coast in California and in Oregon. I'm at Portland State University in Oregon, so of course, some of it was convenience. Some of it was just trying to get that the West Coast way of doing HIAs that have been very influenced by a couple forerunners there. I also chose transportation planning cases just as a way to bound the scope. After that, I looked for different sizes of plans, just to see if there was going to be variation depending on what the size and scope of the plan would be. So what are my three cases? My first case was Clark County, Washington, about almost 4 years ago, I guess, started to redo their bicycle and pedestrian plan. Clark County, Washington is just across the river from Portland, Oregon, in Vancouver, Washington. They like to think of themselves as the rural suburban, and they proudly think of themselves as the rural suburban counterpart to Portland. So the plan itself looked at bicycle and pedestrian facilities in the unincorporated areas. It was a really narrow plan in the sense that you're only looking at active living mechanisms for addressing health. It was done by the health department within the plan on a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant. The second case that I looked at was Lake Merritt in Oakland, California, was doing a BART, that's their Bay Area Rapid Transit Station Area Plan. This station is in Oakland's Chinatown, and the impetus for redoing the station is that there are a lot of publicly owned parcels in the area and that are up for redevelopment, and so they want to turn it into a transit-oriented development. Now, that sounds good for all those of us who have been hearing about how activity is a huge burden of disease, but this is also Oakland's Chinatown, and the elders go out and do Tai Chi on this plaza that they want to tear down to put in some sort of, you know, new urbanist TOD development. And so it became an issue of, you know, whose health matters in this anyways? Large city, large plan, there was an outside consultant doing the HIA, and it was not integrated into the actual planning process, you know, the government-sponsored planning process at all. A third case that I chose, and I chose all of these in part because they were going to happen and they were funded. A third case was the expansion of the Long Beach Freeway down in LA that links the ports of LA and Long Beach to the greater LA area. They want to expand this freeway to 12 lanes because everybody needs a 12-lane freeway in their backyard, especially minority communities that have had it pretty rough for a lot of years. It's an enormous plan and project. There's a council of governments kind of governing the planning process, very messy. There was an outside consultant, actually the same one that did the Lake Merritt, did this other Long Beach plan, HIA, and it was unique in that it was going to be integrated directly into the environmental impact assessment. So it's a case study approach. I kind of did it in a three-phase process. The first phase was kind of a background phase where I looked at all the documentation I could find, all the just everything that was out there publicly available and previous plans to try and make a map that had interests and participants on there so that I could get kind of the scope of what the community, what potential communities should be involved, were involved. And that was done in a kind of hand, open-coded content analysis method. Then, during the second phase, I went through and invited everybody who had participated in the HIA or on the main stakeholder advisory committee of the HIA. I asked them for one-hour interviews, and so these were in-depth, semi-structured interviews, and this allowed me to refine the participants and the information I knew about their interests, and this was analyzed with content analysis, again, in Atlas TI. And then in the third phase, I took that refined kind of scope of interest, and I looked for influence. And so I literally went through the HIA report and plan and environmental impact statements when applicable, and looked for both intent, were the community interests that had surfaced, did they make it in there as they had intended, and for direct quotes. So what did I find? I found that Clark County Bicycle Pedestrian Plan had what I term a weak stakeholder model. This is a model where an HIA author is attending all these county-sponsored planning advisory committees. They're engaging with them, they're engaging with the planners, but they're not particularly initiating community engagement processes. The Lake Merritt BART station area was a strong stakeholder participation model in that the HIA was guided by six community-based organizations who all had social justice at their core and were all local and engaged in that local community. The I-710 became a disaster of a case, both for my dissertation and the poor author. It got pretty much sandbagged and buried, and it wasn't for a lack of trying. So that's always something that can happen when you're trying to engage policy. So we see this kind of diagonal, where we have these limited professional public health professional written HIAs, and then we get more control from the community when we get over to the stakeholder community-based organization representatives. And this graph with the kind of the background also brought out is available, I believe, as a handout through the web program for the conference. So how was the problem being defined? In Clark County Bike Ped Plan, the HIA author was defining the problem. This was okay because there's a robust, active living, active transportation body of literature, and in fact, he was able to really offer a perspective about pedestrians and future users that nobody else was. The Lake Merritt BART station area plan, the CBO representatives really drove it, and that made an enormous difference as to how much community interest surfaced in both the HIA and the plan. And then in the I-710, you know, the problem was defined, and this is something if you're thinking about doing an HIA, by putting it within the actual planning process in the environmental NEPA-triggered process, then the plan alternatives define your HIA, and there's a lot of issues with that. So think twice and call around before you do that. How was local knowledge and information integrated? In Clark County, was that really that? Yeah. Okay. In Clark County, we saw that maps played a really important equity communication tool. And so if you have GIS skills or have somebody who has GIS skills, this is a way to show those social determinants of health in a language that policy and planners can understand. And so even though it was professionally driven, by bringing in those, and they weren't crazy maps, they're very simple maps, by bringing that in, that equity lens and that frame comes through. In the Lake Merritt BART station area plan, we also saw maps playing an important tool to document safety. In both of those cases, things like you would think that the planning agency would show up with the number of pedestrian crashes when talking about a pedestrian-centered plan. You know, you'd think somebody in city government has that. In both cases, neither one did. And it was the health professionals who sought that out to make the case that, you know what, certain intersections are really problematic. It was heavily reliant on CBO reports to document prior conditions, but a consistent theme when I was interviewing people was that they didn't have enough resources to do, you know, primary data collection like they would have liked. And again, in I-710, when you're not allowed to engage in, you know, contractually not allowed to engage the community, then you don't get to have them integrating anything. So where's the influence happening? In Clark County, we saw that the draft HIA was the most influential. So it was kind of an interesting setup. They did a first HIA that was kind of a professionally driven model, then the public health representative attended all these meetings, and then at the end did an HIA on the actual final plan. And nobody read the last one, but everyone read the first one, right? So that tells us something. There was also an instance where they were sitting around and doing some sort of prioritization checklist, and the public health person said, hey, where's public health points? I want points. And they said, okay, what do you want? And so just by being there, right, you get to ask for your points and you get to advocate for health being included. And then, as I said before, it filled significant participation gaps. In the Lake Merritt case, it was also initial letters and memos that were most influential. There were specific transportation facilities that were considered. There were important cultural public spaces that were maintained. Now, those probably would have been argued to be maintained in other public avenues by even the same players, but having the HIA allowed them to point to that, you know, social capital research and other aspects that we have to give weight to that evidence. There were specific design decisions, and one really good example is in an initial memo, it says change, you know, you say that there's supposed to be lighting, but you don't specify whether it's pedestrian lighting. And from then on out, it's always pedestrian lighting. So those are really tangible ways that we can influence health. Another interesting thing is that even though it's primarily a transportation plan, the community was very, very, very concerned about housing and gentrification pressures. And so that was a way to argue for that and to argue for a community benefits agreement. So what do we know? We know that process, particularly early, is most influential. And we also know that sometimes you have to try and insert yourself at multiple points in order to be influential as well. And HIAs must have a robust way to interact with the community if you want the community to influence. So stakeholder forums are still dominating HIAs, and so I have a kind of just a couple that are representative of other ways. We see that in this middle cluster, these are all stakeholder approaches, but there are examples of like this Health Impact Partners prison example up in Wisconsin that are community driven. And so it's not that we're turning our backs on like a CBPR type HIA. They are occurring, but they're pretty rare. So let's see. Robust stakeholder engagement is resource intensive. There's a lot of complaints about running out of time and resources when they wanted to engage. Maps and basic GIS capacity is an important professional tool, and it's a way to speak planners' language. And then finally, evaluation needs to continue to happen for us to understand exactly how HIA influences things. And once we can make that case, we're better positioned at actually being able to fund being at the table. So I encourage anyone who wants to get into this to go and do that. And that would be it.